From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey, we've got a big day. Yesterday was the 190th anniversary of the Miraculous Medal, that famed devotion related to St. Catherine Labouré, the visionary, whose feast day is today, actually, where she received two visions of Mary and was given the design for the medal that was distributed worldwide. Over 1 billion have been struck and distributed. Absolutely amazing. We're also going to be talking about a Marian apparition that may be approved at some point in the future, and that is the Virgin of the Revelation, happening in 1947 in Tre Fontana, Italy. Bruno Carnacchiola, on his way to assassinate the Pope, received a vision of Mary. It's absolutely incredible. You heard me correctly. This story is amazing. So we'll be so excited to talk to someone from the order that sprung from those apparitions. So stay with us for that fascinating discussion. And later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary Project, as we always do. For today, November 28th, we've got the Mother of the Word from Kambeho, Rwanda, in the year 1981. And we're going to be looking at the might-be saint of the day, Blessed James Thompson from York in England, who died a martyr in 1580. In just a bit, we'll be looking at Catholic pub trivia, so get your pens and paper ready for that. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that gets the right answer. People who know me, my friends, know that I love pub-style trivia, so that's why we have some Catholic trivia for you on this show. And the winner will receive the image, The Faces of Mary. It's a photo mosaic of hundreds of smaller Marian images that come together to form a large, beautiful picture of Mary. Send me an email to miraclehunter@ewdn.com, and the fastest respondent with the correct answer is going to win that prize. So last week, we were talking with author Brett Thoman about the Eucharistic miracle at Lanciano. Many people say is the very first Eucharistic miracle. It was an incredible interview, so if you missed it, and you can download the free EWTN app, go to the ewtn.com/radio web address, or connect to the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. The question was, what country is home to the latest two approved Eucharistic miracles? We talked about the first Eucharistic miracle, and that was Sokolka, which was happened in 2008, and Legnica, 2013. So the correct answer was Poland. Those are the two most recently approved Eucharistic miracles from around the world. So on this week's show, we'll be talking about Our Lady of the Revelation from Tre Fontana in Italy near 1947, which has the initial approval of the church, but is not fully recognized as a supernatural event. So today's question is, Italy is the home to the most Marian apparitions throughout history, but how many apparitions from the 20th century from Italy have been approved either by a local bishop or by Rome? So again, that question is, how many apparitions from the 20th century from Italy have been approved either by a local bishop or by Rome? Of course, you can check out my miraclehunter.com website if you want a quick answer and try to beat everybody else. If you think you know the answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com. And the fastest respondent with the correct answer is going to win that prize, and answers and winners will be posted on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the most famous Catholic medal in circulation with over 1 billion worldwide. That, of course, is the Miraculous Medal. Stay with us for that.
Give something meaningful this Christmas, a subscription to EWTN's National Catholic Register. It's the award-winning newspaper filled with solid Catholic reporting from the United States, the Vatican, and around the world. The Register includes coverage on the culture of life, Catholic education, book reviews, entertainment, and features that help subscribers engage the culture with confidence in the saving and sanctifying gospel of Jesus Christ. Order a subscription for a friend or one for yourself and get 26 issues for less than $2 per issue. And with your paid subscription, you'll get EWTN's Life of Christ DVD absolutely free. Save even more and get $10 off every additional gift subscription you order. To take advantage of this offer, visit ncregister.com/radio or call 1-800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
I used to wonder if God really cared, why it mattered what church I went to, or why I even bothered with faith at all. Then I started praying more often and going to church. What happened? My relationships got stronger, and I felt a peace that I never had before. I realized that God in my life was the difference between occasionally being happy and finding lasting joy. If you're looking for something more, check out CatholicsComeHome.com.
Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with program info, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. Just go to EWTN.com/wings. Fill out your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. When you get yours, send it to all your friends, and they can send it to their friends. And pretty soon, we're covering the whole world with the good news about EWTN. Wings, the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. When we talk about Catholic devotions and devotionals, there's a few out there that we see all the time. The scapular, the rosary, of course. But one major one is the Miraculous Medal. That wasn't the original name of this medal, but because it has been spread far and wide, and so many people having these incredible stories of wearing the medal or having devotion to Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, we've seen miracles upon miracles that have been reported. And we have a big anniversary, which is November 27th. Yesterday was the 190th anniversary of the apparitions, or the feast day specifically, of Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, those visions experienced by St. Catherine Laboure in Rue du Bac in 1830. And today is the feast day of Catherine Laboure, so it's the perfect opportunity to talk about this incredible moment in Catholic history where the Miraculous Medal was given, the design was given to St. Catherine Laboure, and then it was spread all around the world. So we're so excited today to talk with Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle. And she's the author of numerous Catholic books, and you know her. People who watch EWTN are quite familiar with her. And her book is The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotions. Welcome back to the show today, Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you so much, Michael. This is right up your alley, being the Miracle Hunter, right? Talking about the Miraculous Medal, and it's the perfect day for that, right?
You got that exactly right. This is, of all the medals in circulation, there have been as many as 1 billion circulated all around the world.
Wow.
So this is something that we've seen many miracles. And your book, The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotions, recounts some of these incredible moments throughout history. But for people who don't know what the big deal is all about, again, we're celebrating the 190th anniversary. What happened? There were two apparitions. What happened on those two apparitions where St. Catherine Laboure experienced something special?
Perfect question. Yes, well, just real quickly, I'll just mention that St. Catherine Laboure was just a simple farm girl. You know, she was, you know, we all should aspire to holiness. We all should aspire to become a saint, as Mother Teresa would say. It's not just the luxury of a few. So St. Catherine was just a simple farm girl, and she aspired to holiness. She wanted to be a nun. Her father said no. And her mother died when she was young, and she took on the Blessed Mother as her mother. She climbed up on a chair right near a statue of the Blessed Mother, drew it to her heart, and said, "Now, dear Blessed Mother, you will be my mother." So she was so, you know, devoted to the Blessed Mother, even as a young girl. And then at 18, she had this transforming dream about this priest that would later be her spiritual director. So there's a lot to the story. I detail it in my book. But then what happened was, as soon as she did enter the convent, finally, enter the religious order, finally, she started having mystical experiences. And then eventually she would meet the Blessed Mother in the chapel. And it was her guardian angel that actually escorted her there. So on the first visit was July 18th, 1830. And the Blessed Mother, it was just beautiful how it all happened. And as she was escorted to the chapel and everything, and waiting for the Blessed Mother to appear. But the Blessed Mother told her many things, many predictions, talked about suffering, talked about many graces that are bestowed when coming to the foot of the altar. So St. Catherine, at the time, Sister Catherine, had so much to think about, and she did speak to her director about it. He said, forget about it. Uh-huh. It was hard for her to forget about it, but she was obedient and went about what she needed to do. And then on November 27th, 1830, which yesterday was the anniversary, as you mentioned, a remarkable vision unfolded to her in the chapel again, where the Blessed Mother showed her the actual front and back of the miraculous medal and instructed her to have them made. In my book, I detail, you know, what the significance is on the front and the back of the medal, what it's, you know, there's a lot to it, and it's really, really beautiful. And, you know, I could mention that if you'd like, but the first medals that were finally struck, the first 20,000 actually, were called Medals of the Immaculate Conception. And that was what they were meant to be called, but they took on another name rather quickly. They became the Miraculous Medal because they couldn't be handed out fast enough. You know, there were so many miracles of health, body, mind, and spirit. So many favors were bestowed through this medal. And it's nothing superstitious, as you know and I know, Michael. And, you know, the church has sacramentals. You know, we have these tangible items. Some of them are tangible items. Sacramentals are holy water, blessed salt. And this particular medal, Our Lady, you know, bestows so many graces through this medal. She said, all who wear it will receive great graces. They should wear it around their neck. She does specify that. Some people, you know, can't wear jewelry or, you know, for some allergic reason. But she does say to do that if you can. And she said, graces will abound for persons who wear with confidence. So that's kind of in a nutshell how it all started, with this little farm girl who aspired to holiness, who listened, who was obedient to that call, and who the Blessed Mother, you know, heaven chose, this humble female saint in the making to carry this message out to the world and to have this, you know, this medal struck so that we can be wearing it now and receiving these beautiful graces.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle, author of the book, The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotions. And you mentioned the medal. It has a very unique design, and it's recognizable to all Catholics who have seen this before. It really sticks out. Let's talk a bit about what does the symbolism mean? Of course, we have the famous phrase on the front, Mary, conceive without sin.
Mary,
conceive without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. What does it mean, those symbols on the back, the M with the cross and the stars? What are all those things representative of?
Yeah, actually the back, I mean, there's a little bit more to the front too, but the back is even more simple, but there's a lot of meaning. The reverse side of the medal presents Mary in her relationship to the church. And there are no words, you know, like on the front we have around the edge, O Mary, conceive without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. But on the back, there are no words, just two hearts, the letter M, you know, a large M, and a cross intertwined with the M are shown on the back of the medal, with 12 stars around the edges. Now, Mary told Sister Labouré that the words were not needed. She said the M and the two hearts express enough. So the back of the medal expresses that Mary is queen and intercessor, mother of the Redeemer, but also our mother who knows our sorrows. So Mary is with us all throughout our sorrows in our lives. And so the heart of Jesus is on the back of the medal too. And he wears a crown of thorns, and Mary's heart is pierced with a sword. So the M intertwined with the cross expresses Mary at the foot of the cross of her son. And the 12 stars are to remind us of the 12 apostles representing the entire church as it surrounds Mary. So we're reminded of the stars in St. John's vision, when a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. So that's, basically what the back of the medal means. It looks very simple, but there's a lot of significance and meaning to
it. And then if we look at the front, we see her hands outstretched as Our Lady of Grace, as people come to know that that image of Mary. What is the front mean as well?
Yes, so the front, it presents Mary in the glory of her Immaculate Conception, standing on a globe, and she's as the, you know, the Queen of Heaven and Earth. So there she is, standing there, the Queen of Heaven and Earth, and her feet are crushing the serpent, showing that Satan and all of his followers are helpless before Mary's power. And Mary is an intercessor. So the rays of light that come from her hands symbolize the gifts and the graces that come through her and her intercession for anyone who asks her for them. So around the rim, as we said, are those words that Mary composed herself. So, you know, we should really be praying those words every day. O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee many, many times, and even to say, and for those who do not have recourse to thee. So there's so much significance on this beautiful medal. And imagine what Sister Catherine at the time had to go through to get anybody to believe her and to do it in this way. And there's a lot of history to that, too, and I recounted in the book about how, you know, the person who made the medal, you know, how it was hard to do a certain version and they had to do it a different way, but it still was still fine with Mary.
We're talking today with Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle about the miraculous medal. Yesterday was the 190th anniversary feast day of Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, and today is the feast day of St. Catherine Labouré, the visionary in that case. And so when we talk about Marian apparitions, there have been thousands throughout history reported and a handful that have been approved by the Catholic Church, but when people want to know what are the most famous apparitions in history, the approved kind, we talk about Fatima, Lourdes, Guadalupe. And right behind them at number four, in my opinion, is Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal as being one that Catholics everywhere can recognize and know about. But people might not know what the true message, they know about the medal, they know the results of this, they know the many miracles that have happened. But what is the true meaning of the messages that were given to St. Catherine Labouré?
Well, there are so many, and the Blessed Mother actually spoke to Catherine for the next 46 years. They had conversations daily, and she actually went to her death, St. Catherine, keeping all this secret except to her spiritual director. Well, Mary, you know, comes to us and tells us we must pray. You know, she did at Fatima as well, to pray for sinners so that they don't go to hell, to pray, you know, for the salvation of the world, to pray for peace in the world. And Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, you know, Our Lady appearing to St. Catherine, you know, told her of these prayers of penance and to trust her intercession, to ask for the graces. She said that, you know, the fingers, the rings on the fingers that don't show graces emanating, the rays emanating, are the ones that people don't ask for. You know, we should continually be asking for the graces to walk forward in faith in this culture we have today, in the world we have today, when we know it's always been a battle of good versus evil. It's always been a spiritual battle, though invisible most times. You know, we're right in the thick of it, especially, I believe, right now, when we have so much going on in our world. So it's a time to really be more fervent in our prayers and to turn to the Blessed Mother and to ask for her intercession and to wear a blessed miraculous medal if we can. You know, many, many graces are attached to it, as well as protection. There's also the grace of a happy death. Sometimes we would want to get a medal to someone who's dying. And so there are so many beautiful graces that come from the Blessed Mother through this sacramental. So I'm not sure if I answered that question properly.
That was wonderful. And we talk about miracles. That's all we talk about in this show. But when we talk about the miracles related to the miraculous medal, we talk about things like the prediction of the Paris Revolution, the incorruptible body of St. Catherine, or Alphonse Ratisbonne, that atheistic Jew who converted to Catholicism and became a priest, or Claude Newman, who was on death row and wore a miraculous medal and converted in his final hours. But your book details some beautiful miracle stories in The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotions. by Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle. What are some of, what is a miracle story or two that really caught your attention when you're putting together this book?
Sure, thank you so much. So I give all the history in the book, and then I include so many different modern-day kind of miracles. But I want to mention real quickly that Mother Teresa, actually the Miraculous Medal was the conduit to my 10-year friendship with Mother Teresa, and she's in here too. Her stories and how she trusted in the Blessed Mother and asked for her intercession and used the Miraculous Medal. But because Mother Teresa had given me blessed Miraculous Medals, and one of them I wear now, I never take off during a precarious pregnancy, she gave it to me when the doctor said the baby was dying. Well, this baby now is 29 years old, thanks be to God. But it was those medals that spurred me on to write a letter of thanks to her after meeting her in Washington, D.C. So anyway, it's a long story, and we don't have time for it now, but that actually is kind of interesting because then after her death at some point, I didn't even plan on it, but I started giving out blessed miraculous medals like she did, and I've, you know, to the tune of like tens of thousands because I know the number because, you know, I buy them to give out and just all over the world in my travels. So I've seen so many amazing transformations take place, countless encounters and just, you know, with wealthy and homeless alike, you know, just all of these people, as Mother Teresa would say, starving for love in the Western world. And if we can push beyond our comfort zone just even a little bit to offer a sacramental from our church, it's just amazing things happen. So if we have time, I want to tell you one of those one of those encounters with this man at a restaurant. But I think it's important to talk about Father John Hardin, who is my spiritual director, and he was linked also to Mother Teresa. Now, he's a servant of God, and the miracle that he told me about at a retreat is really remarkable, and I have it in the book. He told about how he was not the medal-wearing kind of guy. You know, he just wasn't, when he became a priest, he just wasn't, when he was learning to be a priest, he just didn't wear a medal. But the Vincentians had visited, and, you know, he took the card that they gave him, the prayer card, and he enrolled in the confraternity of the Miraculous Medal. So I hope listeners will think about that too. In the back of the book, I talk about how you can enroll in the Miraculous Medal. But anyway, the fathers told the young seminarians, fathers, the medal works, you know. So he's tucked it away in his prayer book, and later on, he was assigned to a hospital. And what happened was, and I'm saying this quickly because I don't want to run out of time. He came across a little boy, a 9-year-old boy, and his skull was fractured. He had a sledding accident, and he had been in a coma for like 10 days or something like that. It was totally hopeless. And Father saw his job at that time. He was a priest. He saw his job to comfort the parents. So he comforted the parents as well as he could. And then as he was leaving the room, all of a sudden he thought, oh, my gosh, that Vincenzan priest. You know, he said the miraculous medal works. So he looked, it was a Catholic hospital. He asked the nuns there, he sent someone to get a medal, miraculous medal. There was no chain. He had to find something. They came up with a blue ribbon. He felt a little silly, he said, but he put it on the boy's neck. And then he asked the father to hold up the prayer that he was to say to enroll the boy into the confraternity of the miraculous medal. And so he blessed the medal, and then they put it on the boy. And he said, no sooner did I finish the prayer of enrolling the boy in the confraternity of the miraculous medal that he opened his eyes for the first time in almost 2 weeks. He saw his mother and said, Ma, I want some ice cream. So it was a total miracle, and the doctors later confirmed that and everything. And Father had said later, he said, this experience so changed my life that I have not been the same since. My faith in God, faith in his power to work miracles, was strengthened beyond description. And he said, the wonders the Blessed Mother performs, provided we believe, are extraordinary. So this is a beautiful miracle that God allowed to happen to strengthen, you know, dear Father Hardin's faith, and to so that he can go on and he can tell this story too and strengthen others. And so our Lord allows, you know, and performs these beautiful miracles. But it might be a miracle, Michael, as you know, and I want to mention to the listeners, that it could be a miracle of health or body or mind or spirit. It might not be, you know, to come out of a coma. It might be the health of our mind, the health of our spirit, You know, and so these are beautiful miracles as well. So there's so much that God can do if we would just allow him to, you know, and surrender to him and pray to the Blessed Mother to, you know, grant us those graces.
Thank you so much for sharing that incredible story. And I know you've got a new book. It's called Prayerfully Waiting, and that'll be published any day now. And your website, DonnaMarieCooperO'Boyle.com, is a place where people can go to find out more information about your books and about all the great things that you're up to. No pilgrimages these days for either you or for me, but hopefully in the new year, we'll be traveling the world again. So thank you again, Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle, for talking today about your book, The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotion. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael, and God bless you and your work.
God bless. That was Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle. EWTN viewers are, of course, very familiar with her and her television and her book writing with EWTN. And the name of that book was The Miraculous Medal, Stories, Prayers, and Devotions. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Does the Catholic Church always require miracles for sainthood? Stay with us for that.
Mother Angelica, answering the call.
We have another call. Hello?
Yeah, hi. This is Sherry, Mother Angelica. You're just beautiful.
Thank you.
First of all, I was born and raised totally Catholic.
Uh-huh.
2 years ago, I went through and committed myself totally to the Lord.
Good.
Born again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, when I was raised totally as Catholic, when I go through the Bible and I read and it does say you must be born again.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense to me. When I was raised Catholic, they didn't really bring it up that much as far as why you should be born again and so forth.
I think it is our fault that we don't understand, we don't explain to our people what it means to be born again. You were born again at baptism. Here's this little baby, it's just a human being with a soul and crying and yelling and screaming, doesn't know beats. Only thing it expresses is hunger. But that little baby, after baptism, has within it the very God who created it. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, that's born again. The apostles were born again. What does that mean? It means a metanoia, a total change. You cannot read the lives of the saints and not know that St. Augustine, believe me, was born again. We call it conversion. They call it born again. If you're talking about feelings, well, we got saints that went, crawled up and raised up into the sky and into trees and into ceilings. And we raised the dead and we healed the sick and exorcised demons. Read the lives of the saints. And believe me, you see some born again people. Mary of Egypt was a prostitute at 12, went into the desert. She got so holy, people came in droves just to ask her prayers. You call it born again. We call it conversion by the power of Jesus.
For more about Mother Angelica, visit EWTNRC.com.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Mother Angelica said that the essence of evangelization is to tell everyone that Jesus loves you. Matt Frad says that it is one beggar showing another beggar where to find bread. Are we so full of the things of the world that we can't hear or receive the gifts that God is giving to us? In Isaiah, we hear, "The Lord delights in you. I've called you by name. You are mine. You are precious in my eyes, and I love you." Well, we often don't want to hear that, and in the Gospel of Matthew, it hits us over the head even more that we're invited to be part of the kingdom of God. Jesus is king, and he's come to establish his kingdom. The Beatitudes are the eight roads to God. They lead us with his gifts of the Holy Spirit to become the new person in Christ who will find happiness and bring that happiness to others. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Love getting your questions. People write in from around the world about questions happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And we had a good question this week from James. James writes in, he says, "Dear Miracle Hunter, did the Catholic Church always require miracles for sainthood? Thank you, James." Well, thanks, James, for that great question. And we all have these assumptions that all the traditions of the Catholic Church date back to the very beginning or very early days, like the white smoke coming out of the Vatican when a new pope has been announced. That's a more recent phenomenon, believe it or not. That isn't an ancient tradition, even though we like to think so. Same with miracles used for sainthood. We can look at the earlier days of the church, and in those centuries, it was the reputation for sanctity and the examination of the virtuous life perhaps were still in play when they announced saints, but they didn't use miracles as definitive proof. I think there are many cases of miracles being worked through the intercession of saints throughout history, and those probably were considered as well, but the actual detailing of the process, the procedures, came about much later. And so we talk about the Italian Cardinal Prospero Lambertini, who was the future Pope Benedict XIV, elaborated on the procedural norms issued by Pope Urban VII for canonizations. And it said that miraculous events in question must present themselves to human reason as being truly extraordinary. It's got to be beyond all natural cause or explanation. And these miracles, they're validated, must involve a serious illness not liable to go in its own with no medical treatment. It's got to be instantaneous, complete, and lasting. And the changes that preceded these, where they first started the procedures that required miracles, that happened by Pope Sixtus V. He established the Sacred Congregation of Rites in 1588, which had the task to conduct processes of beatification and canonization. And it was all the way up until 1983 that 2 to 4 miracles were needed. But Pope John Paul II changed that from 1 miracle for beatification and 1 for canonization. So it's an interesting process, but miracles were not required in the process that we are familiar with today until around 1588. So thanks for your question, James. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, and perhaps we'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day, or the miracle that lines up to that day's date. We all know Fatima May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th, but believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion or Marian miracle for each and every day of the calendar year. People can connect to the Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary. Go to the website, 365dayswithmary.com. You can also pick up the book or download the app, all by that same name. And so for today's date, November 28th, we have the Mother of the Word from Kibeho, Rwanda, in 1981. Now, the apparitions began in November 1981 when 6 young girls and 1 boy claimed to have seen the Blessed Virgin Mary and Jesus, but only the visions of the first 3, 17-year-old Alphonsine, 20-year-old Natalie, and 21-year-old Marie-Claire, have received Bishop Masago's solemn approval. Because there were reservations about the other 4 visionaries and the supposed visions of Jesus, Bishop Masago did not confirm the authenticity of either those visions or visionaries. The Virgin appeared to them as Nyima Wangjambo, which is Mother of the Word, synonymous with Mother of God, as she herself explained. Bishop Augustine Masago of Grincora, Rwanda, gave his approval to these apparitions. And of course, they predicted the Rwandan genocide. And that for today's date, November 28th, we have the Mother of the Word from Kibeho, Rwanda, in 1981. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, connect to the website, 365dayswithmary.com, pick up the book, or download the app, 365 Days with Mary. Now let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this also each episode where we find the might-be saint of the day, and we say from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue, these are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And of course, this lines up to my television show that airs on EWTN called They Might Be Saints. People can go to theymightbesaints.com for more information on that show and for more information on the They Might Be Saint of the Day. And for today's feast day, November 28th, we have Blessed James Thompson, a martyr from England. Now, James Thompson was born in York and educated at Cardinal Allen's College at Reims in France. And he was ordained at Soissons in France. He returned to York to minister to covert, hiding Catholics during a period of persecution, and he took the pseudonym James Hudson. He was sent on his mission in August and was arrested in York a year later, on August 11th, 1582. When he was taken before the Church Council of the Council of the North, he openly confessed to being a priest. This was received with some surprise, as he had been for some years well known in the city. He was shackled and imprisoned, first in private jail until his money ran out, and then in York Castle. Eventually, he was executed by hanging for the crime of being a priest in England, and he was declared a martyr and beatified on December 29th, 1886, by Pope Leo XIII. And that's the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed James Thompson. For more information on this future saint and any of the other Might Be Saints, connect to theymightbesaints.com and check out the show, They Might Be Saints, on EWTN. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the fascinating story from 1947 of the man who saw a vision of Mary on his way to assassinate the Pope. Stay with us for that.
Now, Catechism Wisdom with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Father Larry Richards.
Father Larry, this comes from the Catechism, section 1776. Man discovers a law which he has not laid upon himself, but which he must obey. Its voice, ever calling him to love and to do what is good and to avoid evil, sounds in his heart at the right moment. For man has in his heart a law inscribed by God. There he is alone with God, whose voice echoes in his depths.
Isn't that nice?
Well, but wait. I have my morals. You have your morals. I know what's right for me. That may not be right for you. Who are you to tell me what is right and what is wrong?
Again, what happens is God tells us what's right and wrong, just like we don't tell God. And see, that's the point. Like so often people say, well, I got to make my own decision. And I say, well, if you do that, then who are you? If you think something's right or you think something's wrong, then we should all bow down before you, because then you are God. You decide what's right and wrong. God creates us and he makes the rules. And he writes them in our heart because all these rules are for our good. You know, the church teaches that our conscience needs to be formed in the right way. Because you could be brought up in a situation that you don't know anything or your conscience was ill-formed. But there's still inside of us something that knows we don't go around killing people normally. Now, even that's been screwed up when it comes to abortion. But there's still something inside most people that says to kill someone else is wrong.
If I define my value system, then I am 100% good. Because by definition, I'm doing what I say is good and I'm avoiding what I say is wrong.
And you're 100% wrong then. Because again, you're making yourself out to be the God of the universe. You can't even take your next breath. That's how dependent you are. God could take your breath like that. So you can't be God of your life or your next breath. Who are you to be God of your own morality? It's a lie.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. When we study Marian apparitions, we talk about all these cases. There's a huge range of them. We talk about cases like Fatima, Lourdes, Guadalupe, that have the full approval of the Church as supernatural events, constat de supernaturalitate, as the Latin phrase goes, that the Church will assign to such an event that's celebrated by feast days and canonizing visionaries and the whole deal. But there are other Marian apparitions, some that are completely not considered by the Church. And then there's sort of a middle category, apparitions where they're approved for faith expression, meaning that people can honor these supposed moments of Marian intervention in our world. And occasionally there's a shrine that's built to such a place. And I had the honor of visiting one of these places on one of my trips to Italy recently, and it's called Tre Fontane. And something interesting happened there. They have a shrine there dedicated to the Virgin of the Revelation. And this is a Marian apparition event that was claimed in 1947 by Bruno Cernacchiola, who was an Adventist who was not Catholic, very anti-Catholic, in fact, and had these ideas to assassinate the Pope, believe it or not. But he received a vision of Mary that changed that forever. So we're so excited today, and this is the first time ever on this program where we've had a true expert on the Virgin of the Revelation joining us to discuss this. And this is Sister Emanuela Edwards. She is from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation. Welcome to the program today, Sister Emanuela.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you to share this wonderful history.
Yes, we're talking to you in Rome. Thank you so much for joining us from afar. And this is a fascinating devotion that most Americans are not aware of. And there was a recent article that was published on Catholic News Agency, I believe, relating to a mass that was celebrated by a Roman Vatican official right there at the shrine of the Virgin of the Revelation. So this is kind of it's caught my attention for being significant. But let's take it back to the beginning. What happened on that fateful day on April 12th, 1947?
Okay. On the 12th of April, 1947, Bruno Cernacchiola, who was a Protestant, who had in his heart the intention of killing Pope Pius XII, he, by, what can we say, a miraculous turn of events, he was taking his children out for the day, and they missed the train. They were going to go to the beach, to Ostia, but instead he took them to a different place, to a place known as Tre Fontane. And this is outside the city walls, on the outskirts of Rome. And it's the place where St. Paul was beheaded. It's the place of his martyrdom. And across the road from the place where St. Paul was martyred is kind of a woody area where people would go and, go and play. But it was also, in the evening time, it was a place of sin. But Bruno took his children there because he had something important to do that day. He was writing a speech against the Virgin Mary. He was writing a speech against her Immaculate Conception, which he was about to deliver the next day. And so his idea was that the children could play ball whilst he would sit under a tree and write his speech. And so he was busy with his task, and all of a sudden, and the children were playing, and the youngest one, who was four, Gianfranco, he was reading a comic. All of a sudden, went missing. And so because it was a place that's near the main road, Bruno started to help his children look for the ball while he called out to Gianfranco to make sure that the little four-year-old had not wandered off. All of a sudden, Gianfranco stopped responding, and so he then started to check on his youngest son, only to find him towards this area, this darkened grotto. As he went over, he saw him knelt down with his hands joined, saying, "Beautiful lady, beautiful lady, beautiful lady." After a short while, his second child, Isola, she also fell to her knees and started saying the same, "Beautiful lady, beautiful lady, beautiful lady." Bruno wasn't known for his, shall we say, his patience, and so he was getting annoyed, and so he said to Carlo, he said, "What is this game, this beautiful lady, stop it." And he said, "I don't know this game, Father." And then he too joined the youngest son and started staring into the grotto saying, "Beautiful lady, beautiful lady, beautiful lady." Bruno, at that, was getting really annoyed, and so he tried to move his children, but they were like marble. He couldn't move them, so at that moment he became very afraid. And so he called out, "God help us." And so at that moment, it's as if two hands came out of the grotto and touched his eyes, and he too saw this beautiful lady. Now, the children saw the lady, but she actually spoke to Bruno. And you can imagine, as a persecutor of the church that he was, what she had to say. The first thing she said is, "You persecute me, enough now. Return to the pure fount of the gospel." I am who I am in the divine Trinity. I am the Virgin of Revelation. And so with that introduction, Our Lady then went on to speak to Bruno for an hour and gave him various messages about the faith. Now then, we can come back to the messages in particular. But to finish the story, after the apparition, of course, Bruno then cleaned up the area around the grotto, and then he felt the urge to go and pray. And so he would cross the street and go to the Trappist monastery, where for the first time in many years, he said his first prayer. And he said to his children, I used to tell you that Jesus wasn't present in the tabernacle, but now I can tell you he truly is. It was absolutely amazing. And of course, Bruno then, after a meeting with Our Lady always promises, if you like, some confirmation. And so he was told to go and to say to a priest, Father, I must talk with you. And the priest would respond, Ave Maria, my son, what do you want? And he would actually indicate another priest who would help Bruno come back to the church. And so as you can imagine, after the apparition for 2 weeks, Bruno was searching and searching and searching for this priest, almost going mad because he wanted some confirmation that what he'd seen was all true. Finally, his wife said to him, why don't you just go to the parish church? Bruno didn't want to go to the parish church in reality because, you know, he'd been so rude to the priests on many occasions and verbally abused them regularly. And so in the end, he reluctantly made his way into the church and kind of, what can I say, very in a hidden way, went to the sacristy and said to the priest, Father, I must talk with you. And he responded with a right phrase, Ave Maria, my son, and indicated the priest who would then bring him back into the church, him and his whole family, 3 weeks later. And so Bruno, of course, came back into the church, and he was then given, you know, permission, if you like, to spread the message. He met Pope Pius XII very famously, and he presented to him the dagger that he bought in Toledo in order to kill Pope Pius XII, and also the Protestant Bible. On the dagger, on the handle, it was written, Death to the Pope. And so when he presented the dagger to the Holy Father, he said, Holy Father, I must ask forgiveness. And he said, oh, my son, if you'd succeeded, you would have just added another pope and also another master. Pope Pius XII did give him permission to speak about the message, and so Bruno went on then to found a catechetical organization in conjunction with the founders of the Missionaries of the Divine Revelation, and so he would go around and recount the message that Our Lady had to say.
That's an incredible account. Thank you so much, Sister Emmanuelle Edwards, for telling us the background of the Virgin of the Revelation. It's an apparition unlike any other. Like you say, Bruno Carnacchiola literally had a dagger that said death to the Pope that he was hoping to use in a bad way, and had this incredible conversion. And this was actually, like you say, it was the Pope encouraged him to spread the devotion, and the Vicariate of Rome approved the cult or the devotion of the Virgin of the Revelation in 1947. And so this was an amazing phenomenon. There's a shrine there. I've been there myself, and I think a lot of people are interested in this devotion in Italy. But where does it go next? Will the Catholic Church ever consider this and put it in the sort of the upper echelon of Marian apparitions and give it that full approval as a supernatural event? What is likely to happen in the future?
I think there's a few things to bear in mind in terms of the apparition. That, you know, when an apparition happens in Rome, it's a little bit more complicated because it's always the bishop of the place that has to rule on the supernatural occurrence. But of course, the bishop in this context is the Holy Father. And so the tradition, and this is what happened with Saint Alphonsus de Ratisbon, the apparition de Alfonso de Ratisbon, it was left to the Vicariate of Rome to take forward the formal approvals of the apparition. And so, in fact, there was an inquest founded, and the Vicariate of Rome then appointed the Franciscans as custodians of the grotto from 1956 onwards. And this is a huge step. Then, of course, by the time we get into the 1980s, it was possible to celebrate the Holy Mass at the place of the apparition. And so that is a very significant step by the Church as well. We can also recall that, you know, the Holy Father's vicars have celebrated the Mass at the shrine. And in 1993, the Vicariate of Rome actually went as far as to buy the land that the grotto is situated on. And so we can say that culminates in 1997 when the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, renamed the sanctuary as Holy Mary of the Third Millennium at Tre Fontane. So what can we say? The importance of the shrine is, of course, is moving forward. And we have to make sure that it's known and the message is known all over the world. And in fact, when we think about the Mass that was said there on the 1st of November to celebrate the proclamation of the dogma of the Assumption, we have to remember that this apparition is linked to the proclamation of the dogma of the Assumption, because Our Lady, during the apparition, gave a message for Pope Pius XII. She said during the apparition, "I could not die, I did not die. I was taken to heaven by my Son and the angels." And so this, if you like, was an anticipation of the dogma of the Assumption of Our Lady into heaven. So in Lourdes, Our Lady appeared after the proclamation of the dogma. But in Rome, for the proclamation of the dogma of the Assumption, she appeared before. And in fact, this has a very particular history, because Pope Pius XII, 12 months before, in 1946, issued a letter to all the bishops in the church, asking for their opinions whether it was opportune to proclaim the dogma of the Assumption. He also asked for some supernatural light, if you like, whether he should proclaim the dogma. And on the 12th of April 1947, he received the required confirmation. Mm. This is all a matter of the church documents. We only need to read the official church text to see that this is true.
Well, we're so grateful to you, Sister Emanuela Edwards, from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation, for sharing with us all this unique information that we've never featured before on this program. So thank you for your time today and for your insights on the Virgin of the Revelation. God bless, Sister.
God bless.
And that was Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation. Absolutely incredible discussion about a little-known Marian apparition from Trefana in Italy in the year 1947, the Virgin of the Revelation, and the conversion of visionary Bruno Conacliola, who has the dagger with death to the Pope inscribed on it. Absolutely amazing story. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio. and check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank my guest, Sister Emanuela Edwards, talking about Our Lady of the Revelation, and Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle for that discussion about the miraculous medal. If you're interested in miracles and looking to get out of the country like I am, on April 12th through 22nd of next year, I'll be going to Poland and Lithuania. You can go to pilgrimages.com/miraclehunter for more information. And we'll be going on an amazing trip, April 12th through 22nd, for the anniversary of St. John Paul II's 100th year of his birth. We'll be seeing the original and famous image of Divine Mercy, going to all the St. Faustina sites, Vatican-recognized Marian apparition sites, two of the most recently occurring approved Eucharistic miracles, and miraculous icons like Our Lady of Częstochowa and Our Lady Gate of Dawn. If you love miracles and have never been to Poland, Check out the details at pilgrimages.com/miraclehunter. Sign up for the newsletter on miraclehunter.com for more information on miracle stories, where I'll be speaking next, upcoming book releases, and more. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.